Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm just so excited because we are being joined by one of Britain's best loved actors, star of Downton Abbey, Paddington, Viceroy's House, W1A to name a few. It is, of course, Hugh Bonneville. So I spoke to Hugh last week. He's promoting a new film where he plays the author Roald Dahl, and we talk about that later on in the interview. And you know, he was just so lovely to chat to on a very rainy, gloomy lockdown day via Zoom. I've interviewed Hugh a few times actually, and he never fails to make me laugh. And he's travelled so extensively, both through his work and through being a really keen traveller himself, so we cover a lot of ground. He transports us to the deserts of Utah and to pockets of serenity among the chaos of India. We visit the pristine coves of the Costa Brava and the campsites of France. And he reveals what's on the cards for both Downton Abbey and Paddington. If you're a fan of either or both like me, you'll be very happy with what Hugh has to say. So let's hear from him now. Hugh Bonneville, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. It is such a pleasure to be talking with you today. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you for allowing me into your bedroom.
I've just moved in, so please excuse all the boxes that are surrounding me. So you're taking the day off from your other day job as a vaccine volunteer. How's that been going? What's a typical day like for you as a vaccine volunteer?
Well, it's not as busy as it should be, or we want it to be. At the moment, we're only getting enough to vaccinate to two and a half days a week, and we've got a team of about 80 of us on the rota. So it's a bit like being picked for a school team. You know, you're hoping that each week you'll get picked. The ultimate goal, obviously, is that we'll be vaccinating, you know, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. But at the moment, we haven't got enough supply, as I'm sure is true, you know, in all over the country. And hopefully, that's going to ramp up. So yeah, I've been lucky enough to be picked at least once a week. So that's great for the team, and I'm not qualified to jab. I only got O-level chemistry. So, and I faint at the sight of needles, but I am able to wave my arms around and encourage people through the actual journey of the vaccination centre. So it's been great. And I have to say, the sense of camaraderie and the sense of just doing something, you know, trying to do something to get us out of this mess is really positive. And especially, obviously, the people who are being jabbed, you know, some of whom have not literally left the house for a year. You know, there was a lady the other day saying, "It's I haven't been further than a mile from my house in over a year, and it's so lovely to come into the town." And well, people were saying that when they go online and book, you know, some people have driven 40 miles simply to have the experience of driving somewhere, going somewhere.
Are you sure they're not just driving so that they can come and see you, Hugh?
I think not. I think life's a bit more serious than that. But it's been a great thing. And some of the volunteers themselves, there's a nurse who is a mother of three, and she's got one on the way, and she's a full-time nurse at the hospital. And on her day off, she comes and helps. You know, there are people really going out of their way to do their bit. And so I feel very, very fortunate to be part of this big team that are doing their little bit in our part of West Sussex.
Oh, that's really lovely. And all that hard work that you and the volunteers are putting in will hopefully mean that we're able to get away sometime this year. So today we're going to go on a journey, a wanderlust-filled journey through the seven chapters of your life's travel diary so far. Okay. And we'll start at the very beginning with chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
I think it's a very vivid one, and I've probably got earlier memories, but this is the one that popped into my head when I heard the question. It's camping in France. I'm the youngest of three, and we used to go, mum and dad used to put this tent on the roof, this big canvas thing on the roof, and we'd get on the ferry and go over and travel, you know, wherever. And we must have been in eastern France somewhere, I can't remember, but it was by a lake. And this is such a vivid, I can smell the the tent, and it was after lunch, and I was obviously having a nap, so I must have been very small. I mean, you know, under five or something. And a wasp stung me, came into the tent and stung me. And and mum and dad and my brother and sister were obviously down by the shore. So, I mean, I don't know, 100 yards or something. And I must have shrieked my head off, because it wasn't mum who came into the, or dad who came into the tent. It was the neighboring tent, or in a couple of tents down. The guy, it was a Belgian guy who came in, and he happened to have, he was a physician, and he happened to have some antihistamine or whatever. He had something that helped. And then my mum and dad arrived, and they became lifelong friends. It's one of those, you know, moments in life. And so Michel and Huguette Thierry from Gand, or Ghent in Belgium, became our lifelong friends, all because of this flipping wasp.
Oh, my goodness.
And as a result, I've loathed wasps ever since, and have an irrational fear of them, and just want them, you know, off the planet. But this great family connection was forged. And so I'm sort of grateful to the wasp. And I do remember, as I say, this being on this lakeside somewhere in eastern France.
Oh, that's so brilliant. I love that travel can lead to such random but formative connections, as you say. So was travel a big feature in your childhood? Did you travel a lot?
We, in those days, of course, traveling internationally was far more, you know, far less common than it was, you know, pre-pandemic. And I remember quite a lot of, there was pony trekking in Wales. Not that I was too young to be on the pony, but I was, my brother and sister sort of wobbled off pony trekking. So there were sort of B&Bs in Wales quite a lot. And then this camping in France, canoeing. My brother and dad used to love canoeing down the Loire. So I'd sort of, you know, be sat in my little high chair in the back, in my car seat or whatever. And we'd wander down through the Loire a bit. So that was memorable. And then, yeah, I suppose going to the Costa Brava became in the late 60s, became a bit of an annual thing. Again, driving down or getting up, putting the car on the train at Calais or Boulogne. And I used to love that, the experience of being in the sleeper. I've always loved sleeping on sleeper trains. I just find them so exotic.
Exciting.
And, you know, you wake up and you don't know where you are and all that. And I can remember we'd get to Narbonne and this voice would say, ici Narbonne, and you'd sort of get out and get in the car and then we'd drive the last bit over the border to Spain, to our destination. So and because there were three of us packed in this old Volvo, it was a NUV220E. Why I can remember the number plate, I don't know why. But it was a little old round Volvo, and there was, you know, me sitting on the armrest thing in the middle of with my brother and sister on either side, mum and dad in the front, tent, sometimes a tent or bags, and we're all crushed in there. So either driving down through France or going on the train and then driving through to Spain. So that's a very vivid memory of early years.
And would you say that you had a love of acting from a very young age? Did you always want to be an actor?
I never thought I'd be an actor, but I loved acting. I loved the dressing up box. We had a very exciting dressing up box because my granny and grandpa on my mum's side had been in the Air Force. And so my mum was actually born in Egypt when my grandpa was stationed at Ismailia. Is that how you say it? I don't know. Anyway, somewhere near Alexandria. So on her birth certificate says Alexandria. So she's very exotic. And so she was an Air Force baby. And so they came back with all sorts of Egyptian paraphernalia that ended up in the dressing up box. And equally, my dad, when he did national service, when he was first married to my mum, they went out to Singapore. So again, there was some exotic sort of Far Eastern, you know, bits and bobs and headdresses and shawls and stuff came back. So I spent a lot of my childhood diving into that box and putting on different outfits and pretending I was some, you know, prince from Arabia or wherever I might be and making up these stories. So that was always a lot of fun. Plus any discarded medical clothes that my dad brought home.
Because your parents were both medics.
They were, yeah. My dad was a surgeon and my mum had trained as a nurse before she left the service to have kids. And my brother and sister were very, very good amateur actors as well, very keen. And I used to bully my mates in my road to come and be in my plays. I concede that I'd then go and play football with them, but I'd far rather do the plays on my landing, in which I obviously starred as some, you know, exotic emperor.
Well, it sounds as though there was a love for travel even infiltrating into your performances.
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. And I, of course, as the as one of the shepherds in the Nativity, I traveled a long way following the Star to Bethlehem.
So next up is chapter two, which is the first place that you fell in love with. Where would that be?
Well, it's connected to that first little anecdote, really, or that first journey. At the end of this journey down through France and going to Carcassonne en route as well, and then we'd end up in this little fishing village called Tamariu on the Costa Brava. I'm sure it's sort of completely overrun now and doesn't look like it did 50 years ago, but it was a little fishing village and I completely fell in love. And we probably went 4 or 5 summers in a row when Dad would take 2 weeks off and we'd go on this adventure. And we rented an apartment just up from the beach. And it was a ritual I can recall to this day of going down there. This was an era, I hasten to add, in which my parents or my mum said I couldn't go on the beach until I'd had the olive oil rubbed in. Olive oil!
can you imagine?
I've always wondered why I have this slight tan, but I think it's because I fried for most summers in my childhood. But I
deep fried hue.
Deep fried hue. I fell in love with this little village, place called Tamariu, and play on the beach, make some friends there. And then we'd always go and have calamaris and a Coca-Cola, you know, on one of the bars. And there was this very bolshy guy who ran the bar, Pache's Bar, it was called. And he'd see, if I wasn't with my parents, if I was just with a couple of other kids, he'd just go, a la playa, you know, get on the beach. And so that was that became a sort of family slogan, a la playa. And the landlady of the apartment we were in, she lived downstairs and ran a jewelry shop. She was this very voluptuous, buxom 20-something-year-old. I was about 6 or 7 or 8. And she thought I was the bee's knees. I was the cutest little, you know, and she kept sort of squidging me and squidging my cheeks and hugging me to her ample bosom. And I just found it deeply uncomfortable and embarrassing. And I've seen photographs of her. She was absolutely stunning. But of course, age 7 or 8, my brother, who was 8 years older, was completely salivating over this lovely, this luscious maiden. And I was the one getting all the attention. So that was quite a funny memory.
That is funny. So Tamariu, lots of beautiful hidden coves around that part of the Costa Brava and perfect little beaches. The water is just such an amazing colour there.
It is beautiful. And we used to go out, some other friends of my family used to go there. I think they introduced us, in fact, to the area. And we used to go out on a little fishing boat called the Bella Lola, which was one of those little putt-putt-putt sort of fishing boats. I mean, it didn't have a mast or anything, just a little engine, which always broke down. But we'd go and explore all these coves and bays you're talking about and go around to Agua Gelida, which was then a completely, I know it was just being developed when we used to holiday there. So it was a completely remote, undeveloped area. And then Agua Blava, which was the next bay up from that. And I found it very exotic going to visit all these bays and snorkeling and getting stung by jellyfish. It was all very exciting.
Yeah, lots of jellyfish around there, actually. Yeah, yeah, that's true. So moving on to chapter three, that is the place where you learned the most about yourself.
I suppose there were two. One involved travel and one didn't. One was actually in the summer holidays of 1980 when I was at boarding school in Dorset, a place called Sherburn, and it used to run a summer school with an organisation called FAB, Physically Handicapped and Able-Bodied. And it was really just a summer of, you know, a couple of weeks of fun, but mixing with people who were physically handicapped and as it says on the tin, able-bodied. Mm-hmm. And so I'd not come across people with disability that much in my life at all. And so to actually, you know, spend time and play games with and either push a wheelchair around or, you know, get involved with them stop seeing them as them and actually just becoming one of us, mm-hmm, was quite a sea change for me.
Yeah.
And that popped into my head when I read that question. I did learn about my affection for people, which may sound a funny thing, but I've sometimes been quite shy in my life and I may appear, like many people may appear confident in public, but actually I'm quite reserved. And to actually get out of my comfort zone and to engage with people I might not otherwise have come across was was really quite formative. It was very formative and so enjoyable.
Yeah.
And I do remember having a lot of laughs with the people whose lives were so much more challenging than mine.
Mm.
And that taught me a lot about myself. And the other thing did involve travel, and it was after I'd left school, and I went on a trip through Egypt and the Sudan and Uganda and Kenya.
Wow.
And then subsequently to India. I worked in a bar to earn some money and then went off on this, you know, my gap year. And I look back at that journey that I did on my own, thinking now, aged 50 something, what on earth were you thinking, aged 18, going through all those countries on your own? So many vivid memories, but traveling through Egypt on my own was really great. And of course, as travelers, all travelers do, you hook up with other people and you spend a few days with them or a couple of weeks with them, then you move on and go different directions, but made some, you know, good acquaintances on that trip. But I remember being on a riverboat going up the Nile in the Sudan with a Islamic guy, with a Muslim guy, and him just talking to me about Muhammad and I said, look, I've grown up in the Christian tradition. You know, I'm not a man of great faith myself, but I, you know, and he talked with such passion and open and honesty about his faith. And it's just, again, a little snapshot memory of just with the sun going down on the Nile as we, you know, as our little boat went chug-chug up the Nile. And he absolutely wasn't going to hear anything about Christianity, but was delighted to tell me all about Islam. And we parted as not friends, but we spent an evening together chatting. And that was a very vivid memory. And then equally, when I got to Juba in the south of the Sudan and then wanted to get on hitch a ride through Uganda, the deal was that you sort of hung around the truck stop and got on the back of an empty lorry that had deposited its goods and was driving back south, and you gave them a bit of cash and they'd give you a lift. And that was all well and good, except when we got to the Ugandan border, and the key was to arrive just before sunrise, because that was just after the guards had woken up and before they started drinking again. So the hangover hadn't quite kicked in. So they were still a bit dopey, but they weren't, you know, and they basically wanted your bribes. There was a sort of court jester who was on board with the truck driver, and his job was to entertain the troops whenever you got to a border and keep them happy and give them a bit of a bung. And so they'd let you through without any hassle. And we arrived at this the Ugandan checkpoint, and there was the guard there who, you know, clearly this was an outpost and not a great posting for them, you know, were bored. And they had on their guns, they had their sort of rocket launchers. I mean, they were big. They looked like enormous sort of fireworks on the end of their rockets, end of their guns. And I can remember this, as it were, court jester getting out to give them a bit of, you know, a bit of cash or, you know, a bit of food or whatever and have a chat. And this guy, this soldier just jabbed him in the stomach with this hefty rifle. And I saw the colour drain out of this guy's face, the court jester's face, and he looked scared. And I thought, if he's scared, I think I should be scared. And so that was a bit of well, what I learned from that was I don't like guns and I don't really want to be at border crossings unless they're really quite legitimate ones, or rather ones that are run more efficiently.
Quite intrepid travel from a young age, really.
It was, and it set me up, you know, really, I suppose. I haven't traveled in the same way since. I mean, obviously, you start work and you start a family and your means or your destinations become different. Equally, I then went on to India and had an amazing 6 weeks just traveling across India. And those, as everyone who's been to India will attest, the smells, the colours, the noise, the vibrancy is so intoxicating. And I hankered after going back, and no opportunity arose until 5 years ago when Gurinder Chadha asked if I'd like to play Lord Mountbatten. And I didn't say to her, I'm completely miscast with Lord Mountbatten. I just said yes, because it's going to be in India. So I barely read the script. I just wanted to go back to India. And so I was able to revisit all those sights and sounds again.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down.
So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Wonderful. Well, we'll return to India in a moment. But first, I wanted to reflect also in terms of learning about yourself on your new film, To Olivia. I imagine that part, playing the author Roald Dahl, going through an incredibly difficult time in his life, allowed for moments of self-reflection too. I mean, the film depicts the marriage between Roald and the movie star Patricia Neal, played by Keeley Hawes, at a time in his life that fans of his work really may not have been aware of. I certainly wasn't, that he was going through such a trauma. So what drew you to this complicated role, and what did you learn about yourself through playing it?
I think you've really touched on it there, really, the fact that it was a complicated role and a complicated man and a complicated relationship and a devastating experience that this couple faced. So all those elements really concocted to make it an incredibly interesting project to take on. I knew nothing about Roald Dahl's life at all. Once I'd engaged with the project, I then read, you know, a lot of stuff, and particularly Boy and Going Solo, two autobiographical memoirs, which are very engaging. And you know, perhaps written not with children in mind, but certainly aimed at a more general audience. They're not autobiographies.
Yeah.
They are memoirs, really. And then I read some, you know, more biographical stuff. And obviously had read some of the books over the years, and began to piece together this picture of a really very complicated man, one who'd been through immense pain himself when he'd, you know, spent months in hospital having, you know, hurt his back, having crashed his plane. And the family had been through great pain before the events of this film, when the youngest son, Theo, suffered an accident in New York and was hospitalized and thankfully recovered brilliantly. But that put the family under an enormous strain. And I began to learn what a driven man Roald was. He didn't sit back when Theo was suffering with his head injuries. He actually got together with two colleagues, and they invented this shunt that helped relieve the pressure on the brain. It became a patented thing called the Wade-Dahl-Till valve. That was a shunt
Wow.
that, as I say, you know, helped thousands of children over the
years. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, he was a doer. He was a man who would not sit still if adversity faced him.
Yeah,
I think partly you can analyze it as you will, but you know, probably having been cooped up in hospital for so long, you know, he wanted to grab life and make sure life mattered. So when into this marriage, which was a delicate marriage in itself, you know, Patricia, by her own account in her own autobiography, said that when she married Roald, she was actually still in love with Gary Cooper, the film star with whom she'd had an affair previously. So, you know, this marriage had baggage in it,
yeah,
as well as pain. And so by the time that Olivia contracted measles when she was six, or was it seven? I can't quite remember.
His daughter Olivia.
When the eldest child Olivia, they'd been through immense complications already, and then to lose the daughter to measles as they did was just had a devastating effect on all their lives. And of course, grief and tragedy like this affect different people differently. And the journey of grief, while it can be recognized that I think many people will recognize a sort of pattern in grief, it comes at different times in different people's journeys. And Roald was in the sort of denial stage for a very, very long time. And while Patricia was having to still run the family and keep everything together at Gypsy House in Great Missenden. And it really charts that trajectory of pain, and it's very honest account of both a tricky marriage or a marriage that wasn't just all sweetness and light. It's a complicated marriage. Ruhl was not a successful writer at this time. He was known, but he wasn't the celebrated author that he came to be. Patricia, on the other hand, was hugely in demand in both Broadway and in Hollywood. So that was kept in, there's a tension there as well, professionally speaking. And into the mix, obviously, just trying to cope with, how do you get out of this well of grief? So it was an immensely complex sort of story to try and engage in. And I'm making it sound incredibly gloomy, but I hope it's not.
Yeah, there are gloomy parts to that tragic story. But I think the takeaway message at the end is certainly one of hope and positivity and coming through something awful. And both Roald and Patricia having a kind of creative rebirth once they're out the other side of their grief.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I've been reflecting on this because obviously when we made the film, it was pre-pandemic, and no one could have predicted the resonance that it would have now, which is to do with, as Roald himself wrote, had there been a vaccine around, my daughter would not have died.
Yeah, and that's the message at the end of the film.
Yeah, here we are having this very discussion now. Mm. I'm delighted. I'm in the pro-vaccine camp, and I'm delighted that the vast majority of people in our country are doing the same, because we need a way out of this. And in the film, the way out is that, these are people who have been bereft, and they find a positive avenue through their creativity. And I feel that we, both as individuals who've lost people in this last year, and indeed as ourselves who've lost a chapter of our lives, of every generation, we've all lost a huge amount in this last year, but there can be a positive outcome, there can be a way forward. And I think this film ends on a note of that positivity. And there, I certainly from my own perspective, from my own colleagues, I think there's going to be a great rush of energy, a great rush of positive, creative energy when all this is over. And I think that's exciting.
Definitely. Well, speaking of rushes of creative energy then, I've been hearing in this last week rumblings about a Downton Abbey movie sequel on the cards. What can you tell us? Where are we up to with this? So exciting.
I think there's no secret that there's certainly been a script. Put it this way, it's an analogy I've used, rather than all the ducks being in a row, they're quacking, we're not in a position to get anything into a row because of it would be great to think, wouldn't it, that we can, in the coming months, get the ducks into a row, not just quacking, and then all hop into the ponds and swim. But it's a long way off, I feel, it feels like that. But there is a will to do it. And
cast are all on board?
I don't know. I can't speak for others, but I'm keen to do it. And I know that, the team would love to do it. And I think, the script is gorgeous and fun, and I think would be just the right tonic for when people do get back into cinemas, whenever that may be.
So much the right tonic. And actually, speaking of tonics, please tell me that there's a Paddington 3 also coming up.
Well, again, funnily enough, I ran into David Heyman, the producer, not so long ago, and he said, "No, we're absolutely, we're working on a story and a script, but we are not going to make it until the script is as good as the other two."
So they are fantastic scripts,
which is they are, and they were great. It was a great privilege to be in both of those, and it's very nice to have a producer who's not going, "Yeah, let's cash in and make a third, stuff the script, let's just dive in, get some dosh." He's saying, no, we owe it to Michael Bond and to the audience and to Paddington himself to make it properly. And in the fullness of time, if it's appropriate, we will. So that's a nice
one. Oh, that is great news. Great news. Okay, so moving on to chapter 4, that is the big one, your all-time favourite destination.
Gosh, this is really hard because in terms of hotel, there's a difference between favourite destinations in terms of just place and feel and hotels, okay? So we'll go for the cheap one, you know, the corny option, which is the favourite hotels. I think I'd have to be, the most exotic places I've been are to the Four Seasons at Lando Giravaro in the Maldives, which is just heaven and beautiful. And also Amangiri in Utah. It shouldn't be a hotel. It is the most ridiculous location. It's the side of a rock in Utah. But it looks like a James Bond lair. It's a sort of concrete series of blocks cut into the hillside. And it's the strangest location, but it's brilliant. And the vibe of the hotel is just amazing. And I loved it. I went there on my family, we'd done a road trip a few years ago. And we'd started in Wyoming and drove all the way down through Colorado and down to Utah. And this is near the Arizona border. And it's a stunning place. It's in the middle of it's sort of desert scrub, and it sort of feels like it, as I say, it shouldn't be there, but therefore the atmosphere is unique, and it's got a sort of stripped back feel to it. As I say, these sort of concrete pods, and quite futuristic, but really wonderful, and a great atmosphere and amazing staff. So that was really, really special. And I suppose in terms of other destinations, I do go back to India. I went back to, as I say, do this film about Mountbatten and the partition of India, which we filmed in 2005 in Jodhpur. And there is something about the spirit in India which I just adore, and I can't put my finger on it. And it's not just, actually, there's something, you know, that you go through a city like Jaipur or Jodhpur, any Indian city, and it is like an anthill. You know, the sense of chaos of people just getting from A to B is mad. The buzz is extraordinary.
Yeah.
The number of different festivals, religions, cultures, all in this melting pot. But particularly the sort of traffic. And I know there are obviously, you know, hideous car crashes and everything else. But on the whole, you sense that through the muddle, people are getting there, getting from A to B. They're wiggling around. They've got sacks on their bike, on their motorbike, whatever. They've got a cow in the middle of the road. They're swerving around. They get there from A to B, and they seem to get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
In Britain, mm-hmm. we have traffic lights and roundabouts and road rage. And it's I can't quite get it, put my finger on what it is. But there is something in that Indian spirit, that sort of fatalism or whatever it is, but there is a more of a sense of acceptance about life being tough, and we're getting through it, and we're finding our little wiggly way through. Whereas in Britain, we may have thought we had the world at our feet, and you know, everyone owes us something, and we have these rules and regulations about our traffic lights and our roundabouts, but we're still going to get crossed with the bloke in the car next to me. I find it's very strange, and therefore I find a sort of solace in that acceptance of life in India that you don't find in perhaps more westernized countries. And the perfect chaos. I really, really love it there. And I feel strangely peaceful there. I'm not looking to go to an ashram or anything like that. I'm not particularly spiritual in that sense, but I just do love the energy there. I do.
Makes me want to go. I've never been.
Oh, gotta go.
So next up then is chapter 5, which is your hidden gem. Can you tell me about a place that you love that my listeners might not know about?
Well, I'm not going to tell you my genuine hidden gem, because then it wouldn't be a hidden gem anymore. So my number two. Well, I've got a couple. Again, in fact, going back to Jodhpur. So this is Rajasthan in India.
Yeah.
I'd in the middle of filming or prior to filming, several months before, I'd lost my mother, and I'd never had time to process it, and I'd certainly not read all the letters. Then there were, you know, dozens if not hundreds of letters.
Yeah.
When my mum passed away, and I'd kept them in a bag, and my brother and sister had read them, but I'd not had time or not given myself the space to absorb them. And I took them with me to India, and one weekend in during filming, I went away on my own to this place called Mihigar, which was about 2 hours or an hour and a half southwest of Jodhpur. And it was a little hotel in the middle of the desert, strange little place. And it was probably the most peaceful place I've ever been to. And I was there were only about two guests there. And the owner of the hotel came in from the town to say hello. And I said, how did you pick this spot? It's in the middle of one of those vistas in India that you can literally see for miles and miles of flat. And then you see in the way in the distance, a little hillock or something, or a tree or something. It was just incredibly barren land or quiet desert. And this was a tiny little rise, like a little wadi a sheltered spot or something. And I said, why on earth did you build this little strange little hotel here, which is about 20 rooms, looked like a little fort. And he said, my dad used to bring me here for picnics when I was a kid, and this patch of land. And I said, one day I will build something here. And so it had been a family passion for him, and he'd made it into this very special little place. And it's where I found immense peace, and I was able to read all about my mum. Oof, I'm getting emotional now. But I found it. So it's not a hidden gem, because you can book a room there. You know, it's not. But for me, it was a real place of solace and calm, and I'd love to go back there. And I will when I can, because it meant a lot to me for emotional reasons, but also just to chill out from the busyness of being on a set and all that, and just to be on my own and retreat a bit. So that was really
it was a real
really
catharsis great. For you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, it sounds like a beautiful place. Well, in contrast then, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience. Have you had any real stinkers?
Well, there'd be... Well, apart from train journeys in England, I think it was funny. I mean, like, so, you know, any hiccup on a journey or a holiday or an experience, you hopefully can ultimately look back with, and laugh at it. But it was on that same road trip when we went down through Colorado and into Utah. Everyone, of course, you know, wants to go to the Grand Canyon, and on our schedule, and so lots of people do it on a day trip, but it's probably one of the busiest places one's ever been to.
Yeah.
But we decided I wanted to be there at night, and it made sense for our itinerary. So we booked a hotel, which I suspect was, it wasn't an unpleasant hotel. It was just really grubby.
It's pretty much there's only really one hotel, isn't there?
I'd like to, and I'm not going to say whether we're on the North Ridge or the South, but there are some hotels. This one was particularly grubby and absolutely relied on the fact that it was about the only hotel and that no one stayed more than one night, really.
Yeah.
Because you're either going to go off trekking through the canyon or you're going to head off on your next bit of road trip. So they frankly couldn't give them monkeys.
It's a shame, isn't it? They're resting on their laurels there.
Yeah, completely. And it was where, so my son was with us, and so we needed a Zed bed, like an extra bed for the room. Well, they put a bed in the room, but it was still sort of vertical and had a strap around it. And, you know, you needed a sort of degree and work out how to unleash it and put it down and put all the bedding on and all that. So it wasn't very welcoming. And I'd asked for a really lovely room so we could look over the canyon. But you'd think people had been murdered in this room. You know, we literally all wore our socks in bed because pretty suspect linen. You sort of wanted, I was expected to see a sort of CSI chalk mark of a dead body on the floor, you know, or a stain, you know, where the victim had been found. It was pretty grim. And I remember the poor overworked waiter down in the restaurant with sweat literally dripping into the soup. It was pretty unsavory. And okay. The whole place,
that sounds like a pretty bad one.
Yeah, the place needed a lot of love, and it just banked on the fact that you weren't going to be asked to complain because you were off the next day.
Not going back there then. Well, we're on to the final chapter of your travel diaries, Hugh. Thank you so much for transporting us all around the world today. Chapter 7 is the destination that is at the top of your travel bucket list. What would that be?
Well, having spent some time with the bear from Darkest Peru.
Oh, Paddington.
You know, he told me a lot about his home country. And I've never been to South America. I've been very fortunate to travel a lot across the world. I'm dying to visit New Zealand and Australia properly. I've never been to Australia, but I think top of my travel bucket list is South America. I just think the richness of variety of country and everything I've heard about it, the culture, the, you know, the mountains, everything. I just want to go there. I don't care which country. I just want to go. So that's when it's safe and sensible to travel and time allows, that's where I'm headed.
Fantastic. Oh, thank you so much, Hugh. Those were your travel diaries. It has been wonderful talking to you today.
Well, thanks, Holly. It's been fun chatting and cantering around the world.
Well, that was Hugh Bonneville, a national treasure, I'd say. And I really appreciate how open he was with us. It just shows again how emotional travel can be and what it means to reflect on these moments of our lives. So I'm just so happy that he shared his travel diaries with us, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. To Olivia, a Sky original film, is out on Sky Cinema and Now TV right now. Thank you so much for listening today. If you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you're updated with a new episode each week. And if you can't wait till next week, or if you're new to the podcast, remember there's the first 3 seasons to catch up on, from Michael Palin and Rick Stein to Dev Patel, Poppy Delevingne and Richard Branson. To find out who's joining me next week, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I would love to hear from you. I love reading all of your messages. And share your own travel diaries using the hashtag #TheTravelDiaries. I'll be resharing your hidden gems, your recommendations and all-time favourites on my Instagram and here on the podcast later in the season. Thanks again for listening, and I'll be back next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.